You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library. Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm Abby, and today I have Catherine here recording with me.
We're librarians at the Central Library. We love talking about books, and we'd love to have you join us. If you'd like to be a special guest on the podcast, don't forget to email podcast@jmrl.org.
I'm super excited to share today's episode with you all because it was my first time interviewing a published author. It was such a fun experience, one I will never forget. But before we get to Tracy, let's you and I talk about We Are Not Free.
Absolutely.
Would you like to kick us off with one of your takeaways from the book?
I would. This was a great read. What really struck me about how she crafted this story was it was an amazing balance of conveying the harsh reality of that sort of loss from the perspective of a young person who had even less control over what was happening in that situation than even an adult. And graphically talking about the anxiety and the loss and the issues of justice and fairness, and also striking a note of unity within their friend group. They managed to get through this process and experience by staying connected with each other and relying on each other and using their friendship as a source of support and trying to do the best that they could in a situation which was just frankly awful. So that was, I can imagine, a really difficult balance to strike, and she did it masterfully.
Related to striking the balance, I thought one of my favorite parts of the book was in Yum Yum's chapter. I will just briefly read this quote that I picked out. "As soon as I enter the stall," meaning the horse stall where her family is now living, "I know something is wrong. Fred's suitcase is missing, as is Kuma. Above his cot, the map of the United States has disappeared. My head spins. Fred's gone. He's gone to find our father in Montana, or at least he's going to try. Someone knocks at the stable door. Roll call. I freeze. What do I say? What do I do? I think of the soldiers combing the camp for a little boy. I think of all their guns. All here, my voice is taut and hoarse." Those moments where the plot really speeds up. Mm-hmm. Because we just start thinking, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? So those are the moments in novels that are really enticing when you wonder what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. I just felt like she did a good job of, while it is so grounded in facts and truths and her own family's experience, there is a huge amount of drive to find out what happens next. And unfortunately, it is because it was such a scary situation and there were guards and guns, and there's always that underlying simmering tension, but she peppers that underlying tension with those moments of something maybe big is going to happen.
I agree, Abby. She has done a really amazing job of conveying the visceral experience. This isn't a academic or cerebral exercise in the broader topics of justice and American policy. It's really about children and teenagers going through something that is very raw for them, which leads me to one of my favorite quotes. "The ability to hold your pain and bitterness inside of you and not let them destroy you, to make something beautiful through your anger or with your anger, and neither erase it nor let it define you, to suffer, to rage, and to persevere." And what I really like about that is it's not making light of the difficulty of the situation and just looking on the bright side and being positive and skipping over the angst of it, like really allowing both to exist simultaneously and to let that coexistence be something beautiful. There's so few of us that are able to really be with experiences like that and not walk away hardened or bitter, to allow them to break us open and soften us, and at the same time, hold ourselves and everybody involved accountable. The other thing I really liked was when they were trying to pack, they had to fit everything they had into, like, was it two suitcases? And so he's really going through having to let go of his father's origami. He ends up reflecting on what can I bring with me that doesn't take up any space, and really digging within himself.
Readers can connect with it. So many of those teen experiences are in the book, like identifying these pieces of yourself that are not tangible.
It's really easy to mentally pause a moment and think, if I had two suitcases and it was my entire family's history, what would I bring? And I think basic necessities would be your first thought, but then upon further reflection, it would probably be something like my father's origami or music that my grandmother played. Some of these family legacy items would be lost forever if they weren't brought with them.
But it's true that this situation was so different from that question of what would you save in a fire, because obviously mm-hmm. your circumstances are just so different. And that's what is so heartbreaking about it. One other thing I'd like to add is that I know we have a book list of We Are Not Free read-alikes. One of the books, it's called Internment. It's by Samira Ahmed. It's a futuristic novel that asks the what if question of what if Muslim Americans were incarcerated in the way that Japanese Americans were. I think it's a really great book to read after We Are Not Free.
And our film finale is about a family where there are two sons that ended up on both sides of this issue. One was an American born son, and the other was Japanese ancestry. So they are going through the process of loyalty within the family and addressing how it affects their loyalty to their country.
Definitely head on over to jmrl.org/calendar to see all of the events that we have for the rest of the month. We're just getting started with March, and we look forward to seeing everybody at all of these really cool events and programs. And there are also what we call passive programs at all of the branches where you can go take some materials home with you and immerse yourself in this world of Japanese culture, Japanese history, and heritage in different ways.
Thanks for joining us.
In our next segment, we're sharing my interview with Tracy Chi, author of We Are Not Free. Welcome to the podcast, Tracy. So glad to have you here.
Hi, Abby. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
So to kick us off, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, my name is Tracy Chi, and I am the author of several books for young adults, starting with the YA fantasy, The Reader Trilogy, and soon another YA fantasy, A Thousand Steps Into Night. And then kind of right in between those, I was like, I'm going to write a little bit of historical fiction about World War II. And so that's where We Are Not Free kind of lies, bookended so far by these speculative fiction works.
Very cool. So do you read a lot of fantasy yourself?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I grew up reading fantasy and science fiction. And so I feel like that bug got into me early, like the wondering about, oh, what if magic was real? Or like, what if we were out in space? And so that's kind of how my brain works now. It's always gravitating towards the strange and the wonderful.
And what do you do besides reading? Do you have a lot of strange and wonderful hobbies?
I have the opposite of strange and wonderful hobbies. I feel like I save that for books, movies, writing. And then my hobbies tend to be like, I like jigsaw puzzles. I like hiking in the woods. I enjoy gardening. And so like I have these very mundane things that I like to do, very grounded things that I like to do when I'm not writing. now that I think about it, I don't know if this is related, but I also have very mundane taste in ice cream. I like a chocolate. I like a mint chip. I don't go for those fancy flavors. So I like to think of myself as kind of a hobbit at heart. Like, I just give me my quiet, humble life and then let my mind go on these flights of fancy.
So cool. Well, I look forward to reading your other books, but I will say that my first book of yours was We Are Not Free, which was a little bit more up my own alley because I like historical fiction and like some realistic fiction, relationship dynamics. So I super enjoyed We Are Not Free. And for any of our listeners who haven't read the book yet, I would encourage you to go out and read the book. We're giving away tons at the library. They should be at all of your branches. But if you haven't read it, I'll give a little bit of my take on it. And then Tracy, if you can fill in the details, but just as a premise, it's told in 14 points of view. It's teenagers ranging in age from like 13 up to 18, 20-ish. And it spans these teenagers as they encounter the atmosphere of conflict is the Japanese incarceration, the forced removal. But it's also their everyday life too. That's my premise of it. But yeah, Tracy, fill in other details that are important for readers to know about the book.
Yeah. So We Are Not Free is, as you mentioned, a novel in stories about 14 Japanese American teenagers who are forced from their homes in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor in World War II, and then sent to first some temporary detention centers and then later some more, you know, quote unquote, permanent incarceration camps further inland. And it follows these young people as they are growing up in these really extraordinary circumstances. And part of the inspiration for this book comes from some of my own family's experiences in the Japanese American incarceration camps. My grandmother was 13 and my grandfather was 16 when they were evicted from their apartments in San Francisco and then sent to the temporary detention center at Tanforan. So as much as I could, I drew inspiration from these family stories of the Japanese American incarceration as well.
It's hard to imagine at first thought what it must be like to be that age and to have something like that happen. That's where I think the book is so amazing because it brings that whole experience to life. Even without all of that, it's such a tender age. It's such a difficult age. And so having all of the different voices too was really helpful because every kid is different. So you granted us with 14 different experiences. I'm curious to know who was your favorite character to write and why, and also who was your hardest character to write and why?
Yeah, just touching very briefly on these 14 main characters. We basically only see each character for one chapter each, and then we move on to someone else. And as you mentioned, part of my project with that was to show that there's no one experience. There's no one experience of the Japanese American incarceration. More than 120,000 people of Japanese descent were incarcerated during this time. And so it was impossible to try and tell, you know, just any one story. And so part of my project was to create a little bit of a kaleidoscope to show that people disagreed. Some people really wanted to kind of put their heads down and not be noticed and just get through it. And other people were incandescent with rage, and other people tried to make the best of their circumstances, or other people, their anger was more simmering and below the surface. And so that's why I decided to do 14 points of view and 14 different main characters across 16 different chapters. And yeah, there was a lot of variation in who these people were. I would say one of my favorite characters to write was, I'll pick two because it's hard to pick your favorite child, right? One of them was Betty. And she is kind of our window into these war relocation authority camps. There were, I believe, 10 of them scattered across the interior portion of the Western United States. And these camps were open for 3 years, sometimes four, depending on which camp it was. And so Betty is our window into arriving at these high desert locations, very crowded. They would cram thousands of people into a single square mile of desert surrounded by barbed wire fences and having these dust storms blow through, particularly in Topaz, where a bulk of the book is set. And it would have been obvious to pick a character who shows up at this place. They don't have indoor plumbing in their so-called apartments. They're living in these tar paper barracks. They don't have any really good sources of heat. The barracks aren't finished. It's a huge shock from growing up in San Francisco on the California coast as they were arriving in fall of 1942. And it would have been easy to pick someone who looked around and said, "This sucks. I hate this. I can't believe I'm here. I want to leave. This is terrible. Right? I hate everything." And so instead, I decided to pick a character who took a look at this very bleak situation, right? She's 16 years old, she's incarcerated, and she says, "No, this is the set of my great Hollywood romance. And I'm going to meet the love of my life here. I'm going to go to dances. I'm going to be a social butterfly. I'm going to wear glamorous clothes. And I will make the best of this situation, no matter how bad it is." And I love writing Betty for that. I mean, she was just such a spark of joy in this really, really dire situation. And kind of having that contrast between, she's literally in an incarceration camp. She is an incarcerated person. Her rights, her civil rights have been stripped away from her. And she's like, "So what? I'm going to live my life anyway. I'm just a normal American teenager." And so I really, really loved that. And then another character that I absolutely loved writing and actually felt quite easy to write, even though he's nothing like me, was Twitchy. The character of Twitchy is our window into the actions of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and the 100th Infantry Battalion in 1944 as they are fighting in the European theater of war. And Twitchy is a kid. I mean, he's 19 or so at the time. So he's a young man. He's a kid who really lives on his feet, right? He's a kind of in love with the world and wants to experience as much of it as he can. He's never really thinking things through very clearly. He's not an intellectual kind of guy, as opposed to me, who I'm always in my head. And he's having these really harrowing experiences in combat as they land in Italy, fight there, move to France, lose so many people to the violence of the fighting there. And man, he was just so fun to write because he was so in love with life. Even as he is surrounded by death, he wants to soak it all in. I feel like he's like a kind of character who's like standing outside in the rain with his face upturned, trying to drink it all. And his chapter came out almost all in one piece. The first draft that I sent to my editor ended up looking quite a lot like the draft that ends up in the book. And so I feel like that was a real joy to write, even as the subject matter is really difficult. Ironically, I think the characters that were most difficult to write were the ones that are the most like me. So not like Betty, not like Twitchy. There's this character named Mary, and she is our window into the Tule Lake Segregation Center. So a little bit of background on this. It's 1943. Everyone age 17 and older is required to answer this questionnaire. It becomes known as the loyalty questionnaire, where they have to declare, "Yes, I am completely loyal to the United States. I renounce all loyalty to Japan. I will never be loyal to the emperor," you know, or they say, "Yeah, I'm a traitor. Lock me up," right? It was a very problematic questionnaire and caused a lot of problems within this community. Once people answer this questionnaire, they either get to stay in their current camp, or if they were unwilling to declare their unqualified allegiance to the United States of America. They are sent to what becomes known as the Tule Lake Segregation Center. So all the so-called disloyal, you know, quote unquote disloyal or quote unquote troublemakers are sent to this camp that has higher fences, more security. Well, it becomes very overcrowded during this time. And Mary, who doesn't have a choice in the matter, she just misses the cutoff for answering this questionnaire for herself. She and her family are sent to the Tule Lake Segregation Center, and she is so mad at this situation. She is smart enough to have answered this questionnaire for herself. She is smart enough to know that having to answer this questionnaire after they had already been incarcerated is so unjust, is so wrong. She sees that, you know, her father and brother basically made this decision for the whole family to be uprooted again from their camp at Topaz and sent to Tule Lake. And she is sullenly simmering with rage at the injustice of her situation. And I feel like I felt like that as a high schooler. I mean, I was nowhere near in Mary's situation, right? But I felt like I was at this point in my life where I was starting to see how wrong the world was and how backwards things were. And yet I felt so powerless to change anything. And so I just was railing against these injustices or these wrongs that I couldn't right and didn't know how and felt so small and powerless. And so I put that into Mary's character. And that was really hard. It took me a while to kind of really figure out all the subtleties of her character.
Twitchy was one of my favorite characters to read. I just loved the pacing of that chapter and how it took us into a completely different, as you say, setting, because he's off to war. That in itself was really a jolt in the narrative that was very interesting. You also mentioned Betty, and was Betty the character who had the wig?
Yes.
And when I read at the end, for any of our listeners who haven't read Tracy's note at the end of the book, that detail was also based on your family. I know you said that you tried to weave in a lot of your family stories, and you said that was based on maybe your grandmother who got the wig after the fact.
Yeah, that's right. I tried to have kind of a kernel, like a personal kernel in each story. And so Betty was very much inspired by my grandmother, who was so young at the time that she was incarcerated. She was 13. She left camp at 16, where this was just her regular life, kind of like Yum Yum, right? Is living her regular life. And so just trying to make the best of it, just trying to be normal, just trying to be like anybody else. And yeah, my grandmother, she joined the Girl Reserves, which is like a old timey version of the Girl Scouts. And she was, you know, doing ice cream socials and like going to dances and like organizing all these clubs. And so adding that aspect of just regular everyday life and kind of the regular everyday drama of that, including losing your little brother when he runs away from you because he hates you, was really important to me. And so, yeah, Yum Yum, actually, the kernel of that story, that chapter was, she is our window into the temporary detention center at Tanforan. So it's immediately after the mass eviction from their apartments all up and down the West Coast. And these characters are sent to Tanforan, which is a former racetrack about 15 miles south of San Francisco. And it's a huge shock. I mean, these detention centers were, for the most part, very hastily constructed and shoddily made. And because it was a racetrack and there were already some buildings there, a lot of people, including my family, ended up living in horse stalls. So my grandma, age 13, and my Auntie Mary, who I'm going to talk about shortly, ended up living in a single horse stall. So meant for one animal, a family of eight kind of crammed into this, you know, no insulation, no privacy, one light bulb hanging overhead, still smelled like manure. I mean, it was really, really awful. And it was a huge shock for them. And so while my Auntie Mary, who was older than my grandma, Auntie Mary was 16 years old. And before she was evicted and sent to the temporary detention center at Tanforan, she had been taking these civics classes, and her civics teacher told her and her classmates over and over again, "You're so lucky. Oh, it's so great that you're an American citizen with all these wonderful rights and freedoms." And then they were ordered out of their homes and imprisoned behind barbed wire fences. And the story of Yum Yum looking out through that barbed wire, at kind of the free city beyond her, where all these people are going about their everyday business, that was inspired by a story that my Auntie Mary told me when I interviewed her as part of the research for this book. My mom and I had sat down with her for an afternoon at her kitchen table. She had fed us homemade shumai and Chinese chicken salad and told us about her experiences. And then we stayed the night. And the next morning I woke up, she was already in the kitchen, and she told me, like, "I've been thinking about this all night. I've been thinking about the questions that you've asked and my experiences from that time. And if there's one thing that I want to tell you is being 16 years old, being told that I was American, being told that I had these unalienable civil rights, and then being locked up." And she told me how she'd climb to the top of this grandstand at this old racetrack at Tanforan, and she'd look out over the city and she would think to herself, "I am not free." And she'd cry and think that. And it was something that she wanted to tell me. It's something that stuck with me. It became the title of that chapter, "I Am Not Free." It became the title of the book. Yeah, I tried to attach kind of these personal, as much as I could, moments of significance to each of the characters and to each chapter.
Thank you. And I know we also mentioned at the beginning of this how much there is to say and how many stories there are to tell. And you said that Twitchy's chapter, going back to him, you said his chapter really came together so fluidly that there wasn't much changing to be done. But I'm curious to know, especially because of the style, with there being 14 voices, what did you edit out of the book? Are there any more characters that you wrote and decided not to include, or just details about certain characters that you didn't include in the final draft?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for this question. What I outlined ended up being pretty close to what I wrote, because the way that I structured this and the way that I landed upon 14 exactly characters was, I was thinking about the audience that I was writing for, young people who may not have heard anything about this history, anything about the Japanese American incarceration. And so I was thinking, okay, if I'm writing to them, what do they need to know to understand what happened to this Japanese American community in World War II? And so I was like, okay, we need to know about the anti-Japanese racism and the war hysteria that followed Pearl Harbor and before they were evicted from their homes. And that's how I landed on Minnow's chapter, our very first chapter, when they're still in San Francisco. And I was like, okay, next we need to know about the mass eviction and how that worked. And that's how I ended up with Shig's chapter. And then we need to know about the temporary detention centers. And then we need to know what it was like in those early months at the War Relocation Authority camps. And so I kind of selected these moments out of the history that would hopefully show a bit of a narrative of what it was like living through this time and what you would need to know in order to understand it or begin to understand it. Because of that, I was like, okay, we're going to pick this event, this event, this event, this event. And that's what I ended up with. And so there wasn't that much extra. What there was extra for me was stuff that I found in the research, but could not figure out a way to work into the story, because as big as it is with all of these different teenagers, they're still, you know, mostly from working class San Francisco Bay Area. And there it takes place mostly at Tanforan and Topaz. You see a little bit of Tule Lake, but those experiences were so different. We get a little bit from a character who was in LA. He was from a very, very poor family of farmers who sometimes didn't have enough to eat. And so his experience coming into the camp was a bit different. But this was just in California, right? And so people from Oregon or Washington or Alaska, their experiences were really, really different. And the experiences at the 10 War Relocation Authority camps were very, very different, because they were all handled differently. They were all in different places. They had different communities of people who were there, different leaders. And so one thing that I found in my research was that two of these War Relocation Authority camps, Poston and Gila River, both in Arizona, were actually constructed on Native American reservations. And I found that so fascinating. I couldn't find a ton of information about it. And I am really interested in how that happened. From what I read, it was not willingly on the part of the tribal leaders and the tribal councils. And so I'm interested in kind of, again, that conflict between the United States federal government and these Native American nations and what that was like. And I'm interested in knowing how much these different communities interacted with each other during the time. I would love to see someone tackle this at some point, someone who could speak to it, because I think it's just such a fascinating part and an interesting intersection of history there.
Just as a funny note, I applaud you for not putting in every single detail that you researched. I feel like every time we do book club, we haven't done it yet for We Are Not Free, but one of the most common complaints we get is, wow, this author, you can tell that they felt the need to put in every single little shred of factoid that they found. I think that no one will have that complaint about We Are Not Free, because while it is very well researched and it's so obvious that it's full of facts and truth, it's not like a listicle. You say, oh, it's 14 events. And I see now how you did that, but it definitely doesn't feel regimented, like, oh, this chapter is about X and this chapter is about Y. It does have a nice kaleidoscope effect, like you said before. Let's jump to this question. So besides that history that we've been talking about, the Japanese forced removal and the incarceration, you talked about you wanted to let kids know about that if they didn't already know about it, which is such a great goal. And I think you super achieved it. I think you also did even more. What are some other messages or lessons, or what else did you want to achieve with this book?
Yeah, I tend not to think about my writing in terms of lessons, right? I'm not here to stand at my podium and say, oh, this is what you should learn from this. But I did have things that were close to my heart as I was writing. And I do have hopes for the effects that learning about this history will have. And so one of the things that I held close to my heart was how important this history is to my family and to my community. And so I always tried to be cognizant of the fact that, yes, this is fiction, but these things happened to real people, right? The real people had to endure these hardships, had to suffer through these things, had to find joy where they could. And so I tried, especially because it's not my exact experience, right? It happened to my family, but it didn't happen to me. I tried very hard to be respectful of that and to cleave as close as possible to the truth of the history, while also kind of doing that balancing act of knowing that I'm writing for young people in the 21st century, 80 years later, as of 2022. And so trying to have it be understandable to young people today, even as I am respectful, hopefully, to young people of yesterday, young people like my grandparents were at the time. And so that was really important to me. And then the other thing is about kind of that audience, the audience aspect of this. And I hope that people see this history, that people recognize that this happens. And again, it happened to real people, it happened to my family. And that these injustices, the ones that happened in World War II, are not that far off, right? We say 80 years ago, but that's a couple generations, right? There are people alive today who lived through this. There are people that you know today who have been affected by this. And there are patterns in the injustices of this country, the way that people are oppressed again and again, that I think we can see repeating, right? And so I think learning about this history is an essential part of recognizing those patterns as they play out throughout history and as they are playing out all around us right now. And so I don't go into that explicitly in the book because I stay very firmly within kind of the scope of World War II. But I hope in having that tension or that balance between the teenagers of yesteryear and the teenagers of today that we're able to see, yeah, it's real. Yeah, it's affecting people right now. Maybe not this exact thing, but similar echoes. And so I hope it helps people to think critically about the world that we're living in and hopefully try and change some of those patterns.
And you also said see. You want people to see the history, which leads me to my next question, which was just a fun one. But I loved the drawings that were throughout the book. You have minimal like graphics or illustrations, and then there are some actual, what appears to be a photocopy of a real document. But a few times in the book, it's a drawing. And I loved seeing those drawings. They really brought the characters even more to life for me, their postures, their expressions. I'm curious to know, did you perhaps do those drawings? And also, would you consider this novel ever becoming a graphic novel format?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'll touch on a couple things here. So in between each chapter in We Are Not Free, there's what I call an interstitial. And yeah, sometimes it's a photocopy of a government document, a photograph. Sometimes it's completely fabricated for the purposes of the story. Like a character writes a letter to another character. And I did that because I hoped that these kind of little textural pieces would help bring to life the story, right? It feels different if you feel like you can touch this photograph, or at one point there's the patch for the 4/42nd. And I feel like that adds a reality, a dimension to the story that was really important to me to kind of bring it to life and make it real for people. And so I'm glad that those stood out to you. The illustrations, I always had in mind that we'd see some of Minnows, he's our artist, kind of first chapter character. We'd see some of his drawings that he's doing of his experience. And part of that is inspired by this great book, Citizen 13660 by Mine Okubo. And she was older than these characters. She was, I think, in her 20s at the time of the incarceration, but she drew these things. She drew Tanfran, she drew Topaz. And so you can see her art from that time and you can get a window into what it was like for them. And so I wanted to have a character kind of inspired by that idea. I loved drawing when I was much younger, but I am not good enough of an artist to have my work in this book. No, those illustrations that you see are by an artist named Julia Kuo. She's an Asian American illustrator, and I absolutely love what she did in kind of bringing those characters to life. I love graphic novels myself. I think the storytelling form is so interesting. I don't know that I could be the one to write it because it is such a huge challenge and such a different form, but I would love to see it, right? Because graphic novels reach a different part of the brain and they reach a different audience and they would bring more people, I think, into this history. And I think that would be really, really exciting and really wonderful. I do want to shout out a couple graphic novels that are already out that are about the Japanese American incarceration. There's They Called Us Enemy, which is George Takei's graphic memoir. He was actually in the incarceration camps in World War II. And so that came out, I think, a year before We Are Not Free. So it should be readily available on shelves. They Called Us Enemy. And then the same year that We Are Not Free came out, this artist and graphic novelist, Kiku Hughes, wrote Displacement. And what I love about Displacement, it's a graphic novel, is that it takes place at the same settings as We Are Not Free, follows this character from San Francisco to Tanforan to Topaz, but it's from, like, it's another one of those bits of the kaleidoscope. You see a completely different story. And so an added element of this is that Displacement involves a little bit of time travel. So we have a character who can reflect on the 21st century and what's going on right now, traveling back in time to see her ancestors and her elders' experiences of the Japanese American incarceration camps. And so Kiku's family was also, you know, in San Francisco, Tanfren and Topaz. And so it's, I think, really cool to kind of read these two together and see different resonances and different things that come out.
Thank you for that. I'll put those titles in the show notes and I'll link to them as well. Thank you. That is so cool. Along those same lines, looking forward, but maybe something that is more in your wheelhouse, if you were going to do a sequel to this book, what would you include? Or you can tell me, no, that's a terrible idea and I would never do it. But if you were to do it, what characters would you follow? What might happen? What do you think?
I would love to see what happened after the characters were allowed to come back to the West Coast and allowed back into their neighborhoods. As I was interviewing my relatives and as I was reading these letters that my grandfather wrote to my grandmother, he was drafted into the army and she was back in camp and he was writing to her. And kind of at this period, 1945, 1946. And it's just such a fascinating time that we don't see that much about. They've been gone from their communities for so long, for 3 years, for 4 years, and trying to fit back into these places that they recognize, but don't quite feel like home anymore, I think is really fascinating. So I would love to see what happens with Minnow. And then the other aspect of this, and this is why I'm not sure that I would write it, is that I'm really interested in the fact that after the Japanese Americans were ousted, were evicted from their communities, we'll say, for example, in San Francisco and LA, so Japantown and Little Tokyo, there were a bunch of apartments for rent and there were a bunch of wartime, like good, well-paying wartime jobs available. And so in many of these cases, it was the Black community that moved in. And they were able to move into these apartments. They were able to get these good jobs, get this good work. And so when the Japanese Americans were moving back into these old communities, because of these institutions of racism, right, that forced them out in the first place, and now are forcing them back into these positions, into these old communities where there's not really space for them anymore, there is conflict between the Black community and the Japanese American community. And this is like at the end of the 1940s, leading into the 50s and the civil rights movement. And I'm really, really interested in that tension, right? That tension between the Black community and the Asian American community, because there is unfortunately tension, right? The 50s and 60s, and I'd say probably to the late 1940s and in the aftermath of the Japanese American incarceration helped give rise to like this myth of the model minority, where you could be obedient and try to assimilate into white American culture. And that made you a good, quote unquote, good minority, as opposed to other minority communities, for example, the Black community or the Latinx community, who didn't necessarily think that that was the way towards equality and advocated very loudly and publicly for their rights. And so, boy, I find it so interesting the way that the institutions of white supremacy pitted these communities who should be allies, who should have been allies, against each other in these really divisive and destructive ways that we're still feeling the effects of now. And the thing is that I don't know if I'm the person to write it, right? I certainly don't think I'm the person to tackle that subject alone, being a non-Black person of color myself. But I mean, it's fascinating. And as far as I know, kind of unspoken in young adult fiction. And that's a place that I think we could really see a lot of good stories and a lot of discussion and conversation come out of. And so would love to see that.
Thank you. Maybe a collaboration. We'll see. We'll get working on it. We'll try to hook you up with the co-writer and make it happen, because yeah, I want more We Are Not Free, but maybe I'll just go on to 1,000 Steps Into the Night. I'll just take that as my next one.
It is very different. 1,000 Steps is fantasy set in a completely different world. There's magic and spirits and demons and a road trip adventure. So the tone is very different from We Are Not Free. But after all that heavy historical stuff, you might need a bit of a folklore romp.
Exactly. Exactly. You like to read broadly. So read everything. So Tracy, do you have any final thoughts for us?
Yeah, thank you. First, thank you so much for having me on the podcast and for choosing We Are Not Free as your same page read. I mean, it's really an honor to have so many readers paying attention to this story and learning about this history. Like I said, it's really important to me. And I think to all of us to take a good hard look at where we have been and who we are, and to ask questions about whether or not that's who we want to continue to be. And so I think learning about this history, learning about history in general, learning about the parts of our past and our present that might make us a little bit uncomfortable is really important to our growth as people and as a country. And so I'm really thankful. So thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you once again to Tracy for her involvement in our Same Page program this year. We have great events, programs, and activities for all ages this entire month of March. We hope that you'll join us in reading the book and participating in our special events.
In our next episode, we'll be sharing a pre-recorded conversation filled with warmth and wisdom. We welcomed parenting experts, mental health professionals and advocates, and community parents to come together and discuss parenting and, in a broader sense, navigating the COVID-19 pandemic. I believe that all of our listeners, whether you're a parent or not a parent, will find something in this conversation that resonates.
As always, this podcast is made possible through the generous support from Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org. Please hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss, or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org.
That's all for us today. We'll be back soon with our next episode.